So good morning, Radiant Sangha friends. My name is River. I use they, them pronouns. And I'm a descendant of French and Irish settlers and grew up under the big blue prairie skies of Calgary, Alberta, a place called Mokinsis in the Blackfoot language on Treaty 7 territory. I'd like to thank our teachers, Miyoshin Kate and Shinmon Michael, for inviting me to offer a Way Seeking Mind talk, which I understand is a story of how I came to practice and what practice means to me right now in my life. I'd also like to offer a quick content warning. In my talk, I acknowledge the existence of some heavy subjects like death, illness, and anxiety. So please take good care of yourselves. And do whatever you need to feel safe and comfortable. Got some tea to slow myself down. When I was 5 years old, I pretended to be a rock. I let my parents know, and then I settled down in one spot and sat in what I must have imagined was a rock-like fashion. My parents took this in stride. It was pretty standard for me to play pretend and to communicate various parameters for how I'd like to be treated. Today I'm a shark, watch out, I might bite. Or today I'm Pippi Longstocking, but you can call me Pippi. Pippi Longstocking is a children's book character dreamed up by Swedish author Astrid Lindgren. Some Pippi facts. She's superhumanly strong, the daughter of a pirate, bucks social convention at every turn, and expresses a warm, wild, and playful affection towards people and animals, especially horses. In other words, she's Jizo Bodhisattva in Red Pigtails. I recall through the wispy clouds of memory, feeling very content and at ease as a rock. I remember the heat of the afternoon sun on my neck and the gentle touch of silence keeping me still and upright. I must have really enjoyed being a rock, because my parents told me and still tell me that I kept at it until around supper time, at which point I broke my silence and asked them, what is it that rocks eat? When I discovered the answer was nothing, I decided that life as a rock probably wasn't a long-term career option for me. I'd like to think this was the first time I sat Zazen. Almost 30 years later, I looked to the wisdom of 5-year-old River, who thought nothing of taking instruction from insentient beings like rocks, who somehow knew in their bones how to sit like a rock, something I really struggle with in my practice today, and knew that sooner or later, one must relinquish even the most upright sitting to have a snack or some supper. It brings me great joy to recall the soft margins of my identity as a child, the fluidity and ease with which I moved between gender and even species in imaginative play. Something I treasure about the Dharma is the importance for me of reconnecting with the inherent wisdom of my child self and bringing forward a playful heart to everyday life. I can also recall other moments that brought me to practice, moments where my limited sense of identity was challenged by sudden beauty in which I felt able to open my heart to the world. Hiking to Rawson Lake in the Rockies in deep winter, the sound of my snowshoes cascading off the white cliffs of Mount Sorrel, or meeting my little brother for the first time and feeling his small fingers close around mine. In the 10th grade, my biology class went on a week-long field trip to Banfield Marine Research Station, which is near Tofino. We were introduced to a panoply of invertebrate life, including sea sponges. Sponges do not have a nervous system, digestive system, or circulatory system. They rely on maintaining a constant water flow through their bodies to obtain food and oxygen and to remove waste. They're sort of like a primordial living donut. Humans and sea sponges have a common ancestor that lived 700 million years ago. The researchers there explained to us that they were studying this relationship to discover if we still shared important genetic material with them. And it actually turns out that we do. Learning about this at the time, I felt a familial affection welling up in my heart for our small squishy cousins. That evening, our school group took a nighttime hike to Brady Beach, We each picked a patch of sand and turned off our flashlights. Beneath a sky thick with stars, the water pulsed and gyred with blue-green bioluminescence. Phytoplankton, too small for our human eyes, lit up the swells of seawater, and the frothing surf exploded with light against our toes. In that moment of quiet, I thought I could feel in my body the little pieces of genetic code I shared with sea sponges and the many invisible beings that were lighting up the ocean in front of me. They were suddenly made visible against the velvety dark of the night, and I felt and understood in that moment that each cell of my body contained the history of the entire planet. And for an instant, I felt like I too could glow. You are not it. In truth, it is you. When I first heard this line from our Chinese ancestor Dongshan's teaching poem, The Jewel Near Samadhi, which we chant here at Mountain Rain from time to time, I thought of and still think about this experience. I learned later that this line is from a story from Dongshan's life, and because it summarizes for me how I feel about this aspect of way-seeking mind, I'd like to share it. When he was younger, Dongshan was going around asking Zen teachers at the time whether insentient beings like mountains, rivers, and forests, or maybe sea sponges, could preach the Dharma. And if so, how could he hear it? Eventually, he was sent to Master Yunyan, one of my favorites, who would become his root teacher. And after practicing with Yunyan for some time, Dongshan decided, time to hit the old dusty roads again, and asked before leaving, later on, if someone asked me about your teaching, what should I say? Yunyan paused and then said, just this is it. When he heard that, Dongshan kind of got quiet. And Yunyan, sensing his confusion, said, you are in charge of this great matter. You must be most thoroughgoing. Which if Michael or Kate said that to me, I think I'd get stressed out. That sounds like a lot of pressure. In any case, Dongshan left Yunyan and was still sort of confused. And he didn't really understand what Yunyan was trying to express. Sometime later, though, he was wading across a stream, and seeing his reflection in the water, something in that moment touched his heart. And inspired, he wrote a poem. Just don't seek from others, or you'll be far estranged from yourself. Now I go on alone, but everywhere I meet it, it now is me. I am not it. One must understand in this way to merge with suchness. When I think about the shimmering waves at Brady Beach, or my imaginative play as a child, I have the sense that I've always known that great nature is nothing other than my own bones, skin, and heart. But I also feel like throughout my life, I've had a lot of difficulty in articulating that and expressing it in the way that I live my life. When I discovered Zazen, I fell in love with it. And I think that's because it feels to me like the most appropriate way for me to honor this truth with my body, heart, and breath. And even more so when I feel disconnected from others or confused or tired or afraid, which is about 98.3% of the time. And maybe a little bit more during the pandemic. So far, I've related positive experiences, and those are important to me. But looking back, I also recognize, maybe reluctantly, that my fears, insecurities, and confusion, even my struggles with anxiety and depression, have also served as important guides, leading me by the hand to this practice and to all of you. I remember very distinctly my first panic attack. I was 10 or 11 years old, and I was at summer science camp at University of Calgary. Our little group was touring the University of Calgary School of Medicine and making our way through a library of specimens that they have there. There were skulls that were chewed apart by bone cancers, lung tissue damaged by years of smoking and sectioned into little slices, all kinds of things preserved in formaldehyde as teaching tools. I remember only experiencing wonder and anxiety. Wonder and curiosity. The anxiety comes later. These specimens were somehow abstract and unreal to me. They had nothing to do with my own life or my own body. But after a while, I entered a room, and in front of me was a large glass container. In it was a dissected human leg. It was incredibly well preserved, as if it were still attached to a living person. But as my eyes traveled up the leg, they met carefully exposed muscle and then finally parallel alabaster lines of the tibia and fibula. What struck me at that moment was that this was not the leg of an old person who had passed away from natural causes after a long life. The skin was smooth like my skin, or like a young person's skin, and the muscles were full and powerful. Suddenly, I was confronted with something real, not an idea, that this had belonged to a real person that had lived, and I felt almost viscerally that this person and I were the same, that this was my leg. I remember my whole body shaking as if I was suddenly very cold, and a dull pressure closing in on each side of my head, as if it was being squeezed by something. No matter how deeply I breathed, I could not get enough air. I remember running to my camp counselors on the pads of my feet, like a forest animal fleeing a predator. From then on, panic attacks were like a childhood bully, showing up unexpectedly at the worst moments. In grade 5 math class, forcing me to cling to my least favorite teacher as if she were a piece of flotsam in a sea squall. Or in the middle of the night, just waking up, breathless, my body shaking from a nameless, indescribable fear. Even when I felt okay, I had the sense that death and illness were always there, waiting to snatch away everything I loved. I've wondered if having serious asthma as a young child played some role in this. I have soft-edged memories of nights spent at hospitals, a mask tied to my small face. I remember my parents sitting beside my bed, trying to disguise their tired eyes with smiles and storybooks. Only a few years later, when I was 12, my grandmother died while she was on the phone with my family. We were discussing our day, and I remember that she complained of being unwell. Not seriously unwell, but just the kind of way you'd complain about a cold or a sore shoulder. It seemed more like an inconvenience than anything serious. But suddenly she stopped speaking. It turned out she had suffered an aneurysm while she was on the phone with us. We sent a neighbor to go help, and they rushed her to the hospital. I went to school the next day, comforting myself with the idea of my grandmother being fussed over by doctors and nurses. Doctors and nurses at that time seemed like authoritative, almost superhuman people. It really didn't occur to me that they would not be able to make her well. So when I came home that night and my father sat me down and told me she had died, I refused to accept it at first. I remember trying to argue with him about it. And I think the mark of a future lawyer is trying to argue with death. I'd actually just spent the whole summer with my grandmother, which was something that was pretty regular for me growing up. I was helping out at her ranch and volunteering at the local senior center with her, which mostly involved drinking probably unsafe amounts of milky tea, playing Chinese checkers, and being doted on by smitten retirees. The last 2 weeks of the summer, we spent time together at Victoria Beach on Lake Winnipeg, and I remember loading my things into my parents' car, and I remember hugging her goodbye. I still think back expecting that I was owed some kind of warning, some little notification popping up on my phone to say, this is the last time you'll hug your grandmother. Young River, becoming the rock, somehow knew that the only way to understand something is to embody it and to learn it from the inside. And speaking to my mother recently, she said, this is how I've learned everything. Said, you don't do half measures, River. You go inside things and you learn them from the inside out. So no surprise, at the side of my grandmother's casket at 12 years old, I became determined to work in the funeral industry as a means of thoroughly understanding and coming to terms with death. I think that same determination to embody something I didn't understand would many years later deliver me to Azendo. In high school, I actually managed to land a job as an apprentice funeral director. I basically pestered the local funeral home every few months for a job, and either impressed or exasperated, but I'm starting to think maybe it was more exasperation than anything else, the partners said they would hire me when I got my driver's license, which I then rushed to do. I think most kids my age wanted their driver's license so they could go to the mall or go on dates. And I did do those things in my ketchup red 1988 Ford Ranger. That's right. I do have some Calgarian bona fides after all. But I would also go straight from math class on Friday night to hosting evening prayer services and viewings. I spent Saturdays and my high school summers picking up bodies from hospital morgues and sneaking cucumber sandwiches after long receptions. There are parts of that job that I truly cherished. And thinking back, there are also things I adore about Zen practice. The power of form and ritual as tools to confront and be present with difficult feelings and experiences. The intimacy and immediacy of caring for a body, living or dead, which leaves very little room for anything but mindfulness. In the end, I was also able to address my fear of illness and death through kindness and service to others, which for me is the foundation of Zen ethics and something that drew me to our style of practice. But by the time I graduated high school, I'd become really disheartened by the funeral industry. Even though I loved supporting people who are grieving, the industry felt like an elaborate mechanism for disguising and avoiding the reality of death. You might be wondering how a kid who had a panic attack at the sight of a dissected leg might come to work in a funeral home. My mother had that same question when I told her I was taking the job. I was very privileged, really lucky to have parents that understood that my anxiety and my depression were not my fault and were very supportive in my getting the help that I needed from an early age. So I started going to therapy from around grade 5 and continued all the way through high school. Through therapy, especially cognitive behavioral therapy, which was in fashion at the time, I was able to gradually manage my panic attacks. It's one of the accomplishments I'm most proud of in my life. Even though I still have panic attacks on a regular basis, and my anxiety is still a challenge for me, they've also taught me some valuable lessons that probably saved my life looking back, and ultimately, I think, opened my heart to Zazen as a way of living. At first, human sensations and emotions can be managed. As Mr. Rogers famously said, anything human is mentionable, and anything mentionable is manageable, including illness, death, and grief. Second, I internalized the wisdom that the intrusive, often disturbing thoughts that provoked my panic attacks were not the real me, that my real I was something deeper, that could watch thoughts arise and choose how to respond. I didn't necessarily have to follow those intrusive thoughts or that catastrophic thinking to its end. Over the years, a few of my therapists recommended meditation practice or indicated that what they were teaching me, breathing exercises, body scans, were inherited from Buddhist practices. I find it really funny that I don't think many of them were Buddhist practitioners or Zen practitioners, but they like to recommend meditation. And I'm very grateful that they did that. But as a curious teenage bookworm, I would come home from some of these therapy sessions and I'd express an interest in Buddhism to my parents, who as nominal Catholics didn't really know what to do with that information. Though they always encouraged me to learn new things, I actually think their encouragement of my curiosity, both my imaginative play as a child and my appetite for learning weird things like funeral directing, made it possible for me to be open to paths like Zen. In any case, when I was 14, my dad had the bright idea to give me his big banker's box of books from his university days. There was a copy of Chogyam Trungpa's Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, which for a 14-year-old kid was a very cool title. Plato's Republic, some very outdated books on punch card computing. And there was also an old copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, with the cover falling right off. My little brother told me recently that he still has this copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind on his bookshelf. He brought it to Vancouver from Calgary. I was immediately drawn to the book by the back cover, which is a large close-up of Shunryu Suzuki's face. And this is not the book. This is a hardcover. I learned my lesson. But that's for those who haven't seen it, that's his face. And I felt, as I think many do, that just looking into his eyes, he felt like exactly the kind of person I would want to sit and talk with if I was feeling upset or afraid. And reading it, I felt, again, like I think many do, that someone was speaking directly to me about my own life. I felt like the chapters were addressed specifically to me. And so I think from that moment, I felt a sort of instant, indescribable affinity for this practice. There was no Calgary Soto Zen in those days. There were absolutely no YouTube videos, no YouTube, and absolutely 100% no meditation apps. So all I had was Shunryu Suzuki's instructions on Zazen. I stole one of my mom's overstuffed decorative cushions, sorry, mom, and dutifully pretzeled myself into full lotus. Another example of being outsmarted by a younger river, because I actually have no idea how I managed to do that. I can't even figure out how I got my legs that way, but there you go. What I would do is I would read a short chapter from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and then I would sit for 10 or 30 minutes, usually until my legs started to hurt. I remember sitting on that decorative cushion, imagining my breath as a door swinging open and closed, or as water falling to meet a river. Amid the intense anxiety, fear, discomfort, and sometimes suicidal thoughts that dominated my teenage years, these otherwise ordinary moments of sitting in my bedroom stand out as precious moments of rest and ease. It felt like coming home to and making peace with my body, my breath, and my hurt. Without community and teachers, my solitary practice, even though I loved it, soon dwindled. I'm not trying to be hard on myself, but remembering how difficult it was for me to sit alone without the support of others, I've always felt very strongly that I'm able to follow this practice thanks to all of you. This practice of Zazen has quite literally become the central love of my life. And so I feel that I owe every person who practices with me near and far in past generations and in years to come my life. All alone, I decided to move on to other books. First, those in The Banker's Box, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism by Trungpa, and then Plato's Republic, and then on to my undergraduate degree in philosophy and social thought. I hoped that if I read enough books and learned enough things, I would be able to figure my life out. Spoiler alert, that didn't work for me. Everything I encountered felt scattered, made up of or drawn from too many traditions. I practiced yoga through university, but the practice at that time for me felt purely postural and physical, missing the kind of holistic life orientation that I was seeking. This is something I really cherish about my Zen practice. It enfolds and unites the emotional, intellectual, and embodied paths into one coherent way of living. It took me a long time to return to Zen. In 2014, I was in law school and felt totally miserable. My ability to cope with my anxiety was crumbling at that time. I was very worried I'd made a terrible mistake going to law school, and I wasn't really sure what direction my life should take. At that time, Jessica and I had been together for about 2 years, and she was a big support in helping me identify more clearly my longing for spiritual practice and community. Jessica has always encouraged me in my way-seeking mind, even before coming to practice herself. I recalled those moments of joy reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So in the spring of 2014, I Googled Zen in Calgary. Thank goodness Google was around at that point, and started to sit with the community in Calgary. Bhaizan Tim Sampson, the resident priest in Calgary, was my first mentor. And I am so grateful to him and all my Dharma friends in Calgary, some of whom I think are here today. Tim taught me to cherish Zazen and especially emphasized the importance of sitting with other people. Tim also instilled in me an appreciation and reverence for the inherent beauty of Zazen. Tim sits beautifully, always taking time to arrange his robes, settle his back, tuck his chin. I've always tried to bring the same attentiveness and grace to my own sitting practice. It's a lifelong effort for me, but it is a joyful effort. Tim also introduced me to haiku writing as a practice, and I think of him anytime a haiku comes to me during Zazen, which I know is naughty, but it does happen. Zazen quickly became my galactic center. the empty space around which the rest of my life turned. I'm someone who has a hard time making it to the gym or waking up on time, probably because I have a hard time going to bed on time. But somehow I've always miraculously managed to find my way to the cushion. During my articles, which for those of you who don't have law in your life, thank goodness, articles are a torturous year-long apprenticeship in law that generally involves 12-hour days. I moved into Calgary Soto Zen for some portion of that, into Calgary Soto Zen's house of practice, Little Tea Temple, so that I could start each morning with Zazen and a soothing round of temple cleaning. Over time, I've had the incredible fortune to develop a relationship with Michael and Kate. I first met Kate and Michael during their visits to Calgary for our weekend retreats. Pretty soon, I started schlepping out to visit Mountain Rain for our Loon Lake and Sea to Sky retreats, on one occasion showing up in a rented high school prom limousine, which was the most cost-effective option to get up to Loon Lake that year. In 2018, I found a wonderful excuse to move out here to Vancouver to practice with all of you darling people. I was offered work at the YWCA Metro Vancouver as a lawyer for survivors of intimate partner violence and as a violence prevention educator. I'm convinced that my practice has delivered me to this work. It's not so much that I made intentional choices, but that my practice has given me the courage to imagine a life I feel proud living and make little leaps into the unknown from a place of stability and self-compassion. I'm only half joking when I say that I let Canon Bodhisattva take the wheel. On my first day of work here in Vancouver, I arrived at my bus stop to find it was in front of a Buddhist altar shop on Kingsway. There was a rich assortment of statues of Canon, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, crowding the windows to see me off. I imagined for a moment that one of these Dharma mamas might offer me a bag lunch and a kiss on the cheek. Okay, I thought, I'm on the right track. Even so, I don't think that practice requires that I or anyone else do a particular kind of work, or any work for that matter. If anything, I think my practice just directs me towards activities that are in harmony with my true self at this moment. I'm actually very curious to see what future rivers get up to down the line, and I think I would have a hard time guessing. From Kate and Michael, I have learned to honor the mountains, trees, and rivers as the embodiment of Shakyamuni Buddha. Kate has helped me to search for Dharma in poetry and mushrooms, and Michael's warm presence in my life has helped me, as a genderqueer person, to heal my relationship with my masculine side. Michael models positive, humble, gentle, and compassionate masculinity in a way I find deeply inspiring. The rootedness of our practice at Mountain Rain in the wilderness is the result of Kate and Michael's unique style and their many years of leadership. Because of their efforts, I am finally able to align my life with the life of sea sponges and phytoplankton. And I find that totally miraculous. I also deeply appreciate the teachings I've received from everyone I practice with. My Dharma sibling and one of my closest friends, Shogetsu Melanie Hudson Drake, with whom I received the precepts and shared my first awkward years of practice. Shungetsu Jessica Magnet, who collaborates with me to transform the great love story of our lives into a way of Zen practice. Some other examples. There's Yuki David Burke, who helped me, an insufferable know-it-all, shake off the stink of overly intellectual Zen and make my practice something real and concrete and vulnerable. There's Josh Hoiberg, who showed me how Zen practice can commingle beautifully with fatherhood and tattoo art. I think my own artistic approach to practice started with Josh. Here in Vancouver, in Calgary too, there are way too many Dharma friends and siblings to name, and I'm too scared of leaving someone out. Plus, new people are constantly joining our Sangha and dazzling me. So there's no way I can even approach an exhaustive list of the people I love and owe my practice to. So if you're listening to this now or sometime in the future, I love you, and I can't wait until our provincial health officer authorizes me to hug you again. The first time I sat Zazen with a group, I immediately fell asleep. I felt a lot of shame about it at the time, but now I think it was just what I needed in that moment. I really can't explain it, but I felt completely at home and safe. In March of 2018, when I received the Bodhisattva precepts, I received the Dharma name Daisen Shinkyo, Great River, Faithful Home. Dharma names are like this, made up of two names, one that describes you, and a second that offers a possible direction for practice. At least that's my beginner's understanding. I've always feared being rejected, unloved, and unwelcome by others. This fear has caused me to suffer quite a bit in my life and to inflict suffering upon other people, and especially the people who are close to me. My engagement with Sangha has been a place of struggle for me. But at the same time, I think since my first day, I've known that Zazen, and especially Zazen with other people, is my true home. Wherever I sit Zazen together with others, I sit with family. We are all koi fish swimming steadily towards the Dragon Gate together. And the more I practice, the more I start to think that no koi fish has reached the Dragon Gate alone. Parallel to my practice, I've also traveled towards a better understanding of my gender identity. I'm non-binary, meaning I identify as neither a man nor a woman. This has always been the case, though I have not always had the words to give voice to it. From a young age, basically around the time I started to have panic attacks, I have also felt a sense of deep discomfort in my body and with how my gender was treated and viewed by others. I think I dealt with this by pushing it down and becoming disengaged from my physical body. Zazen makes that impossible. In practicing Zazen, I've had to come home to my body, at first with tears, and more now with open hands and heart. One thing I've done to express my gender is choosing a gender-neutral name for myself, and it felt right for me to use my Dharma name. Now, every time I introduce myself in court, or give a workshop as a violence prevention educator, or my partner tells me she loves me, or that I've forgotten to wash my cereal bowl, I'm reminded of my vows and how much I owe to my beloved Sangha. As I continue to swim upstream, with all of your help, towards the mysterious Dragon Gate, my way-seeking mind now asks, how can I create refuge and family for any person who seeks the Buddha Dharma? How can I protect and preserve this intimate family style of practice to make sure it responds to the needs of people today while still correctly transmitting the marrow of Dogen Zen? How can I make Zazen the rooted center of my life while also responding authentically and usefully to racism, colonialism, sexism, and transphobia, and the climate crisis? These are questions I don't have to carry alone. I don't travel alone, and perhaps I've never traveled alone. And I feel that we can live these questions together. This year, I've received permission from Kate and Michael to sew Buddha's robe and explore ordination as a priest. I don't really know who this river will be who puts on the patched robe, but I hope you will support them and their way-seeking mind as you support me today. And I extend to you all a sincere invitation to come play with me. Thank you very much for listening.